Anna has to say so. Anna, take it away.
But I'm related to an abolitionist who was a slaveholder.
Oh, that's good. Okay.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't.
And good afternoon, Richmond. You are listening to The Defenders Live. I am your host, Anna Edwards, and today is Monday. The Defenders is brought to you as a production of The Defenders for Freedom, Justice, and Equality, and you can learn more at defendersfje.org and defendersfje.blogspot.com. Nowadays, you can not only follow Defenders Live on Facebook, but also with its own blog. So that'll be Defenders Live Radio. blogspot.com, and there I'll try to post more of the links and information about my guests and the topics that we cover on this show. Today is September 19th, 2011. Happy birthday to my friend Reggie and many others out there who I'm sure are celebrating or plan to this evening. It's a good day. It is a beautiful day. I stood on my front porch and marveled at the absolute just perfect beauty of this day. And so it's a good day to be the first week of our WRIR fund drive, but a particularly good day to have as my guest, someone I've wanted to have on for a long time, is Dr. Edward H. Peoples, who has been a legendary, and legendary along with other legends in Richmond and in Virginia, and in the country. Notably, your work on the Prince Edward Schools school closings, and but many, many other things. So anyway, before I run off on a rambling preface and introduction, hi Ed.
Hi, nice to be here. And before we start, I want to say, thanks to all the work that you do, and Phil and all your colleagues carrying the torch further. It's burning brightly, and I think we'll light up the
another
future
generation.
For us.
Yeah, yeah. I think that's it. I think it's that's one of the most important things to remind ourselves, is that we do carry torches. We have picked them up from others who have done phenomenal and amazing, sometimes subtle and amazing work that allows us to do what we get to do now. Yeah, yeah. So, Ed.
Yes.
I met you several years ago, and you have been sort of tracking us, and it took me a while to figure out, you know, who's this guy who's sort of keeping up with what we do. But your career has been long and varied and rich, and one of the things that you pointed out to me was that a lot of your work has been done out of your relationship to the American Friends Services Committee and the Encampment for Citizenship.
Yeah.
And, you know, a friend of ours who's a union organizer heard that you were going to be on the show, and he said, you make sure he talks about the Encampment for Citizenship. And I had never heard of it before.
Yeah.
So go.
Well, it's been shut down for since the 90s. The conservative movement evaporated all the funds.
Mm.
It was 50 years old. It was founded just after World War II, when the founders in New York, at the Ethical Society in New York, it's religiously just left of Unitarianism, if you can imagine such a thing.
Right.
And Algernon Black, a leader in the war against housing discrimination, and several other people in New York, founded the encampment in 1946, based on a look back at World War II, and they said this is the most racist war we've had of this magnitude. And it tells us clearly what is not democracy, but what, in essence, in the positive terms, is democracy.
Mm-hmm.
And they said the message is important, and we have to tell it to the youth. And so they organized an encampment for citizenship It started at the Ethical Culture School in Riverdale, which is in the Northwest Bronx.
All right.
And that's where I went in 1957. So you see, it was 12 years old by that time. And
moving
but
strong.
But many Richmonders have gone.
Yeah.
If you've ever heard of Laverne Bird Smith, who was an activist in Richmond too, she went in 1947.
Wow.
And she's still living here in Richmond, and I recruited heavily in years gone by. But I went in 1957, and it is a six-week summer experience for young people. In my day, it was for college age.
Mm-hmm.
Eleanor Holmes Norton was in my group.
You mentioned that.
And
yeah.
There are many, many other people you would know who were in various years. Barney Frank, one of our watchdogs in Congress, is a grad of and many, many others.
You mentioned Peter Neufeld.
Yeah, Peter Neufeld, the Innocence Project. I, in 1966, I ran the first one that was ever attempted in the South, and that was in Barberville, Kentucky. That's coal country, and people don't think of that as deep South, but I guarantee you, if you read the chapter on that encampment summer, in this manuscript I'm trying to get published as a book, you'll understand that it was just like Mississippi once racism gets started.
Right.
And Neufeld was a 17-year-old, wet behind the ears, kid who came to the encampment along with others that went on to same kinds of activist careers later on. And he was just 17 then, and he told me one time that this was one of the two most important experiences of his time. I feared that the kids would be discouraged, especially the black kids, because of the hate that was so much present, that they would lose heart in the hopes for democracy.
Sure.
But most of them did not. And many of them came activists and worked all the harder. And through the years, I've been a part of it for the last 40 years of its life. I did it all. I was a speaker. I was a fundraiser.
Mm-hmm.
I recruited kids across the South. My specialty was getting Southern kids because
mm-hmm.
it was hard to get Southern white males.
Mm-hmm.
And I had, as a boy, learned to talk their language.
Now, are you from Virginia originally?
I grew up in South Richmond.
Okay.
I was grew up in my working class. My mother was a hairdresser. She went to the eighth grade. My father was more of a advantaged person, but he was an alcoholic, and what didn't work a lot of the time.
Yeah.
And so we had to leave him. So South Richmond was even more so than South Richmond, if you know what I mean. It was white dominated, of course, and all the institutions you see there now that have their share of blacks didn't. It was totally controlled, and I went to school over there, and my mother was so afraid of the trouble I was getting into that she moved across the river and ended up living on North Side until we left my father. So I had all the makings until I was 18. I never heard anyone, a preacher, a teacher, a parent, any relatives, clerks in stores, delivery person, nobody who wasn't in favor of segregation. And any time the topic of race came up, it was in connection with black inferiority and white superiority. So I, like all the kids I knew, and my brother, I have a younger brother who's very much like me, except he's better.
Oh.
he's not a public person. He's a doer.
Right.
And I'm very proud of he's younger. And we knew nothing else, and so you can imagine the kind of behavior. There will be accounts in this manuscript about the horrible things that we saw and did. And but as I got out of that and went to RPI, some of your listeners may not know that RPI stood for Richmond Professional Institute, and it's the forerunner of VCU.
Right.
And at RPI were some dedicated professors. It was a no-name school at the time. It didn't have very many people. Didn't have many students. It was under 1,000 students when I first went, maybe 1,800 when I left.
Wow.
And these faculty were so remarkably dedicated to working-class people, and it was it was white, all
mm-hmm.
white,
mm-hmm.
And so dedicated to getting rid of segregation and other progressive issues that I refer to them as educational missionaries
mm-hmm.
because they came to our land
mm-hmm.
and to convert us
mm-hmm.
to
mm-hmm.
modern late second half of the 20th century thought,
right.
And so I enjoyed the pleasure of several of them. The most remarkable one, I'm always trying to get people to write biographies about heroes and heroines in Richmond.
Right.
One of them is Dr. Alice Davis. Her story, we don't have time to get into it, but
yeah.
It's a remarkable story who in the 30s became a friend with Eleanor Roosevelt. She organized in Coal Country, West Virginia, and she loved us students, and she's had impact on hundreds and hundreds of hundreds of people, and our RPI alum folks all remember her, whether they're conservative
mm-hmm.
or liberal or radical.
Right.
They remember the effect she had on opening their minds.
Right, right.
So the encampment was a place where we generated leadership for progressive things, and of course, people chose all kind of careers out of that, and we have about 7,000 living alums,
yeah.
And there probably were 10,000
yeah.
Graduates, and we have. I was able to had the good fortune of having a good relationship with the VCU library because my papers are there.
Yes, yes.
And they are so it's so important that we save the records of Central Virginia activists, and they have a remarkable collection of all kinds of activists there,
mm-hmm.
And we're building daily. To expand it and make it a solid research and also enlightening experience for students, but also serious research, and I was able to get the encampment people who were establishing a new alumni association, and we started a collection for the encampment there, so you can. You can go on. You can't go online yet, but you can go down the library and see the materials and the people,
right.
And we'll be collecting that for years to come, and you will discover some very famous people in the Kennedy administration,
right,
and every progressive movement in the country.
Can trace people some came, people.
And people don't realize we are Easterners. We don't know about the Native American movements.
Uh-huh.
But there were lots of leaders who came forward out of the encampment. And in the farm, agrarian and agricultural movements
mm-hmm.
that were progressive.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it was multicultural in every respect.
Yeah.
So it was a remarkable influence on me in 1957. I had the good fortune of going, and I had written Martin Luther King a letter in 1956, in the late 56, commending him on the boycott and his accomplishments in the boycott. And was I stunned. In January, I got a letter back from him thanking him for showing solidarity. And so I got to the encampment that summer. And, of course, who came to speak but Martin Luther King? And while he was very kind and generous, I'm sure he didn't remember my letter. But he and I had a conversation, and he thanked me once again and thanked the other students who show solidarity with the civil rights movement at the time. This was 1957. I also had an afternoon with our group. We had 120, what you'd call students, with Eleanor Roosevelt. And I had a nice conversation with her. And of course, Ralph Bunche not only visited us, but we heard him speak at the UN.
Right.
And they were just three examples. Actually, I was elected. We had a town government, and I was elected the vice president, and they had a black, high-powered guy from UCLA who was elected the president. And he left early because he had responsibilities for leadership at his university, and it left me to conduct the to master ceremony at the banquet at the end, and I was expected to make a speech, and Ralph Bunche was in the room, and I was such a nervous wreck that because I was really out of my element. There were so many erudite kids, New Yorkers, who fast pace, and here was
were they ready?
From Hillbilly Heaven, a redneck out of water.
That's right. That's
and
right.
So the encampment is a remarkable thing, and we're trying to recreate some of the experiences, if not a national one, at least locally, and we're just getting started and getting in motion. We have a website. And we're going to improve that.
Yeah. You're talking about the alumni website, which is EFC Alumni. That's it. Encampment for Citizenship, EFCAlumni.com.
And it's will be improved as time goes on. Some of my local friends agreed to help us get that started.
Mm-hmm.
And so as time goes on, you will see more and more about it, and we hope. But it's an essential experience for youth leadership for progress.
Right.
And enormous prospects for connecting nationally.
Yeah.
And through the encampment, I got support for Richmond activities.
Right.
Because of my connections with other progressives in every other state. Including North Dakota and Wyoming.
No kidding.
Can you believe
far
it?
Far reason.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I'm sitting here trying to calm down from imagining what it must have been like to have been a part of that in those years. And of course, this is one of those experiences that you have when we get to talk to folks who went through the civil rights era in the 60s and the 70s, but when there was this overwhelming sense of forward motion around progressive issues, and when there were some very, really stark and obvious things to tackle.
Yes.
And, and everything, you know, nowadays seems to be so muddled and subtle and interwoven, and we're all compromised, you know, almost by our very existence, you know, living in today's society, that it's harder.
Well, I soon learned, being in the civil rights movement, that demonstrations weren't enough,
mm-hmm.
that you needed intelligence.
Mm-hmm.
And your organization does a lot of that.
Mm-hmm.
You go out and get the facts, and you can embarrass people who withhold liberties from people. And that's why I took up an academic career, because I twisted my academic career away from just the career itself, but to say I'm going to use my research skills and my knowledge of life sciences and social science to react to problems on the ground.
Right.
And, of course, I didn't retire. I never made professor because that wasn't the rule in the academy.
Yeah.
But I leave behind projects and maybe a couple of disciples who see that we need an information arm.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
big time.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to arm people, and just the scattered websites is not enough. It has to be really thoroughly organized.
Yes.
And summarized in ways that's handy.
Yeah.
And your newsletter and other such things. Many people are trying this, but we still need to find ways to effectively distribute it for people who are going to act on that.
On that information. I think you're right. I mean, one of the pieces, when you talk about, you know, the intelligence, it is the information, it is the facts, and then it is both the arena and the ability to analyze
exactly.
that information and then organize and act
on it. And get yourself, an array of specialists who can handle
mm-hmm.
who can handle the analysis.
Right.
And we tried to do that in the Richmond Human Rights Coalition starting in the 70s, when we discovered there were going to be a bunch of fractured caucuses
mm-hmm.
in the civil rights
mm-hmm.
movement. We pulled together 9 human rights organizations, and we made sure we used expert opinion to make our stand and go to city council
and
general assembly and
that's
wherever
right.
else we were
that's
doing.
That's right. That's right. Which is a little bit reminiscent of what folks are trying to do with the Virginia People's Assembly.
Yeah.
And, you know, as usual, our conversation is taking us rapidly towards the close of the show. But in the last 5 minutes that we've got, I want you to talk a little bit about the documentary.
Oh, yes.
Prince Edward.
Well, one of my things that if I had 15 minutes of fame, I guess it was my work in I went there in 1959, disgusted with what Virginia was allowing when they closed the public schools and would not appropriate money for them, and the Commonwealth supported it. It was Harry Bird's idea because he thought Prince Edward was the perfect place for it to happen.
Mm.
And so I went there as a volunteer and organized some kids and adults and kids in Central Virginia to go down and show solidarity through recreational programs and training of the kids who were out of school.
Mm-hmm.
And that led to me meeting Reverend Griffin and others in the American Friends Service Committee. And that evolved into, through the U.S. Civil Rights Commission and the Virginia Council on Human Relations, for me to do research, which ended up as a master's thesis at University of Pennsylvania, which led to the feds were being embarrassed about us ragging on the Soviet Union for the treatment of their people.
Hmm.
And around the world, I met, when I was in Prince Edward, I met French and German and English newsmen, reporters, who were talking about the international reputation of America,
right.
And Kennedy became embarrassed about that.
Right.
And so we are pressing out people and telling the Soviet Union their bad news. In any event, we are making a film about this story.
Yeah.
And thanks to this dedicated guy, Brian Grogan, who I've worked with now for about 11 years,
yeah.
And we're short on the money, but we're right down to the wire.
Right.
And so any help, people get hold of me through you or what have you.
Well, or directly, because I think that there's info at mercyseatfilms.com.
That's right. Yeah,
yeah,
look
so
for there.
The website is mercyseatfilms.com. And the email is info@mercyseatfilms.com.
Yeah, the whole story's there.
Yeah.
And how to connect with us is there.
That's right.
And if you're a person who was affected by that, by all means get hold of us.
Yeah, I think it's very...
we're about 85% done, but we still have a little room to interview more people.
Yeah.
But we need that final editing money. Yeah. And that's the tough part.
Well, that's, yeah, people can learn more, both about the documentary and the work that you all have done on the issue. So I think it's the two pieces that I'm interested in, because you're right here, you know, is the fact that you went down there and you helped, you know, with some education, with the recreation, and that it really, I think, is, again, looking at that catalyst you built on the work of people like the Friends Association and
Friends American Friends Service Committee,
and you know, and the Encampment for Citizenship. Those are two powerful demonstrations of what organizing, along with the knowledge base, and then along with the commitment and the drive.
Yeah. But don't let people get away from that. You have to do hand-to-hand combat as well.
Absolutely.
One-on-one. When you're there, yes, and you're alone, and something happened,
yeah,
you speak up.
That's it. Dr. Ed Peoples, thank you for joining us
today. I was thrilled to be here with you, because I admire you and your colleagues so much.
Well, I can't tell you what it means to be admired by people who have really been through it, who have been through the hand-to-hand combat, the mind-to-mind combat, and
yes,
and are still at it. I mean, you know, you're talking about your work is archived, that the resources are there for people who
telling
are doing
the story,
that research, telling the story, and you're still doing that work. Yeah. So,
well, thank you so much
for joining
me. I appreciate it. I really appreciate being on your show.
Yeah. Well, I want to thank my listeners for tuning in today and remind you, of course, that you're listening to Defenders Live as we close out the show, that we are in the middle of our fund drive, and that you need to give us a call at 622-9747. You can donate online at WRIR.org, and you can also, what else can you do? You can walk in, 1621B West Broad Street, right across the street from Lowe's. There's always food and people who are ready to welcome you in and let you know how good they are. How good your efforts at keeping us on the air make them feel. So I want to thank you again for tuning in. Thank you, Ed, again.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's a joy to be with you.
We'll see you on it. We'll do this again.
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. And remember to keep up the struggle, and that kindness does matter. And we will talk to you next week.
You're talking so sweet, well, you needn't. You say you won't cheat, well, you needn't. You're tapping your feet, well, you needn't. It's over now, it's over now.